You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KBOO.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you.
Race.
This is a life or death story. By the time it airs, there's already been bloodshed by gun violence over and over and over again. LTAR discusses gun violence in America, as American as cherry pie. What are the underpinnings of the gun violence epidemic in America?
I think it's important to acknowledge that the gun violence, the violent epidemic that we are experiencing now, while it is horrible, it is based on the legacy of violence in this nation. We all recognize and remember the wise observation of, I believe, H. Rapp Brown, who says, violence is American as cherry pie. And I think if we look at the history of this nation, it is rooted in violence and oppression of peoples. From the initial entry of European invaders into this nation, where they massacre indigenous people, to the importation of Africans into this nation, through the continued effort to uplift the powerful, violence is part of who we are. And to offer a different perspective is to go against the natural grain of our society. So I think some of the things that we can do is first acknowledge and recognize our history, which is related to another discussion about how our history is taught, but also to recognize that because gun violence is so endemic to our society, we have to recognize that our society has to do a systemic change that begins with first recognizing that we are literally soaked in the blood of, and that we need to find other ways in which to work together and to stem violent confrontations? How do we meet challenges? How do we engage with one another? How do we resist so much in ways that are life-affirming rather than life-denying? It's a hard, difficult question. And I think that we will begin to answer that when we begin to ask hard questions about who we are and not who we think we are.
Professor Johnson?
That's a huge question. Going through some of the research and looking at is interesting because the research is rather incongruous in that some areas are heavily researched and some things aren't even looked into at all. We have often spoken about our inability to address mental health issues. But when we look at some of the recent cases, they are grievances that people are driven to the edge, I guess you would say, around workplace grievances or personal grievances, divorce. And I think these kind of monumental events that cause people to break down and not really know how to address it and wind up in this area of actually being suicidal. And then it plays out with other people or people being targeted. It's just so broad, it's really hard for me to get my head around some simple statement around what causes this or to be able to speak to what the underpinnings are. I think there's so many. And when we're talking about mass shootings, we're saying shootings involving three or more people, I think, is the newest way they're defining it. So we're not even talking about all the other people that wind up dead at the end of a gun for domestic violence and crime and other reasons. The underpinnings are just too hard for me to really speak to with any degree of that I've really captured it.
Mary, your thoughts?
I absolutely agree with you, Professor Johnson, in terms of the feeling of overwhelm, the feeling of helplessness. What can, what would, this feeling of complete inadequacy to have any impact or to be able to understand enough to be able to have impact. And I think we've got to fight against that as hard as we can, because it plays into the dynamic of we cannot know, we cannot understand, thus we can do nothing. And in the face, in the vacuum of doing nothing, these kind of horrific acts of violence continue to move forward. And I feel almost like it doesn't, as you said, the research is very sketchy, if it exists at all. It's very inconclusive, if it exists at all. And yet, I can't help but think common sense might drive us or show us a pathway towards some type of action. And I am a person who believes that even incrementalism has its role, has its moment. And if we could just make things a little bit better, maybe it's not the universal panacea, but if we could just make things a little less worse, harm reduction, could we practice our harm reduction in this movement? I want to talk about the underpinnings of this epidemic and go way, way back. And I want to go back and say that I believe this epidemic started with the theft of the land from indigenous people and the theft from the land of its resources and attributes from the enslavement of Africans. State-sanctioned enforcement of these two economic realities through the use of violence represented by gun. And if we can understand who had them, who did not, who got to use them, who did not, the origins of police as the, you know, the vigilante groups to return enslaved people to the enslavers. That, I think, is the origins of this. And it is over these, you know, the years of this country has been co-opted into a white supremacy culture that uses this agenda against Black and Indigenous people of color, women. Dr. Johnson was talking about domestic violence, the others, and of which we all are. I want to harken back to the Great Replacement Theory. So this understanding that somehow white people in particular must defend themselves and their women, let's go back to misogyny, against, you know, the great hordes of people of color. And we've talked a lot on this show about the Great Replacement Theory, the moment when, and it's here in many places, Monterey Park, for instance, where the most recent murder killings happened. It's here in many places when the minority becomes the majority. And that day is hurtling along for some white folks. And the fear and the fear-mongering and the use of state-sanctioned violence and the tools of state-sanctioned violence to enforce or to oppress people of color in this moment, I think are all part of this gun epidemic.
I agree that it's a difficult and complex question, and I would echo what's been said here. The thing that comes to mind for me, thinking about the underpinnings of gun violence, and like Mary said, I'm also, you know, maybe more interested in half measures than I normally am. What are the actual concrete steps that we can take? Because to truly look at the issue is to be overwhelmed. To understand it is to be bombarded with the enormity of it all, right? But the first word in gun violence is gun. That has to be a big part of it. And we are in a unique society that wants to waffle on that topic. In 23 states, I believe, brass knuckles are banned. We can ban weapons. That's allowed. Switchblades, a lot of places are banned. You know, you can't go into a sporting arena with certain things on your person. It is not unreasonable that living in a society, there are certain things we're not going to do so that we can all get along, right? And I think the underpinnings of gun violence are, of course, what my fellow panelists have pointed out. This legacy of white supremacist, male-dominated violence that has been enacted towards all peoples in our society and including to other white men. A lot of victims of gun violence are white men. A lot of perpetrators of gun violence are white men. The guns play a big part in it. They're very, very lethal when we talk about this stuff. So I think understanding the root psychology of where all of this comes from, what is the power fantasy that people want to engage with? When is it a defensive mechanism? When people are looking at a world that is something that scares them for whatever reason, Mary brought up some good reasons that people may find themselves to feel the need to be able to enact this kind of violence, because it is a particular kind of violence. It's not bar fight violence. It's not punching a punching bag in your basement kind of violence. It is specifically enacted on other people because it's a level of impunity. And I think the underpinnings of it's obviously a difficult question to answer, one that has many answers. But I don't think that should stop us from trying to answer it, stop us from having all of the conversations about different aspects of it. I've certainly seen that mental health has become a larger aspect of, especially talking about mass shootings and people who've become alienated and enact this kind of violence. But I don't think that the conversation should end there. And it's certainly not a coincidence. We spoke about how some of the studies on the issue are not incredibly fleshed out or conclusive, but you can look at other developed nations in the world and compare the number of gun deaths. And there's a big disparity there. Even if you want to go per capita, they do not have the access to guns that Americans have. And what has the access to guns gotten us aside from living in terror, right? So I think that ought to be part of the conversation as well. And that maybe the Second Amendment is something, I know folks talk a lot about it being misinterpreted, but maybe it should be reinterpreted altogether. Maybe the Second Amendment isn't feasible in today's day and age.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
You are listening to LTAR, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie. When we're talking about gun violence, and specifically with mass shooting events, which Professor Johnson defined as three or four victims, what are the common threads between perpetrators of these kinds of violence? What can we take from that? Let's start with Mary and go from there.
The common thread, and Althea, you just spoke to this, is gender in terms of between perpetrators, between and among perpetrators. Men are by far and away the ones who are utilizing this tool called a gun in these mass shootings. I think when we understand or look at the statistics for suicide, and for accidental shooting and the shooting of children, that dynamic changes a little bit. However, when we are talking about these mass events, we're talking about men, and we're talking predominantly, I'm gonna say it, white men. The common thread, that's not exclusive, I'm very much aware of that. The common threads are what we were just talking about in the last question, which is economics and racism and white supremacy culture. And I want to be super clear that my vision of freedom and equity and equality for women, for people of color, for all sorts of different folks is not that we can get to take up the tools of the oppressor and use them against ourselves. That is not my idea of liberty. That is not my idea of freedom. That is not my idea of having arrived in terms of full access to and benefit from the benefits of the society and culture. It's a pretty simple through line for me. It's based in gender, it's based in misogyny, it's based in racism, and in the end, it's based in economics. And once we understand that, I hope it becomes easier to see where we might take, as you say, Althea, half measures to try to address some of what we're seeing here and hopefully prevent.
Reverend Cecil?
What are the common threads between perpetrators? You know, whenever there's a mass shooting or whenever there is terrible activity or terrible crime, we often see commentators come and pontificate about why this has happened, whether it's social. What's wrong with our society? What's wrong with our education system? What's wrong with our families? And among the common threads, I think of perpetrators, they all have access to guns. Violence did not begin with guns and will not end with the elimination of guns. What's common among all the common thread we see is at least access to guns, whether it is, you know, someone who had training in the military or whether it's someone who had access to their parents' locked up gun closet, whether it is someone who was able to go into the corner gun store and buy a gun, or someone who had access from a friend or stole a gun. What is common is the numbers of guns in our society. In the United States, where there are more guns than there are individuals, I think that is a problem, and that we must recognize that our society is not so unique than other society, and that the level of gun violence is so much higher in this nation than in just about any other nation. So we have to say, what is wrong with our nation that we have access to so many guns? And, you know, certainly, as I noted, that guns and violence is part of our nation's history and is part of our, some might say, our DNA. But I think it's also the possibility that we can resist that, and we do not have to say, well, it has always been and so it will always be. For me, it's interesting to look at nations such as Australia and New Zealand, who had, although different, somewhat similar history in terms of frontiers and introduction of Europeans into their society and the worship of guns. If those societies were able to overcome their reverence of guns and move in another direction, I think it may be possible. It will take lots of work. It will take years. I think it's possible to move away from bowing down before the altar of guns and guns violence, and to find another way to seek solutions to problems, and to find ways in which to remedy, and to find ways in which we can solve problems.
You are listening to LTAR, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie. Your analysis of what these perpetrators have in common is very apt and accurate. I would expand on what was mentioned about white supremacy culture and the ways that that manifests, especially in the American context. The privileging of the individual above all else, I think, is an important aspect to highlight as a part of this, that there is not support for the good of all. There is a certain, I want to say valorization, that's the word that comes to mind, of the individual's right to do whatever the heck they dang well please. And even if you don't like it, well, that's part of why it's good, is because I get to do things that people don't like. And that's special and good. And if we take 2 seconds to start to break that down, everything starts to fall apart. And many, many aspects of American culture can be attributed to that kind of thing. Another thing that I think plays in is death anxiety. Seeing this, like Professor Johnson mentioned, continue to happen around the country with how helpless people become, that motivates more death anxiety. And what is death aside from, what is death representative of if we can't conceptualize it as the non-existence of our physical person? What is your spiritual death based on what you believe? And I think that motivates people in a lot of ways too. There's a study about this. I can find the exact one, but how it motivates people, that one's own views about death influence how you feel about the death penalty, influence how you feel about what does it mean to deserve to die. And to put that power into somebody's hands with ease of use, with the availability of guns, I think is something that we need to analyze. And what are we trying to protect when we are giving into this kind of death anxiety? The other thing that I would highlight, especially as it comes to misogyny and the ways that men in particular enact this kind of violence, there was what I thought at the time was a kind of out there satire of the gun violence issue on a Netflix show called BoJack Horseman. And on this show, in their fiction, it was not until American women en masse started carrying handguns that sensible gun reform was passed in the United States. And when that came out, this was a couple years ago, gun violence was still bad at that point. But that was, oh, what a silly satire. It's and the punchline is, which does America hate women more than it loves guns? And the answer in that program was yes. Increasingly, we find ourselves in situations where satire doesn't feel like it goes far enough, or real life seems like it would be satirical if you told it to someone 2 years ago. But I think we can't ignore the ways that there are these connections between perpetrators, the way that there are connections between what motivate people to do this, and how can we intervene on that? And why are some of those possible interventions supposedly out of the question? You are listening to LTAR, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race. internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
For my next question here, I have a quote from the Washington Post that I would love to read for you. It says, quote, "Half of mass attackers in the United States were retaliating for personal, domestic, or workplace-related grievances, and many used firearms that were obtained legally, according to a Secret Service report published days after a man in California shot and killed at least 7 people in what authorities believe could have been an act of workplace violence." End quote. What do the panelists make of this research? Let's start with Professor Johnson.
These personal grievances or workplace grievances or something that was a specific challenge that has driven people to do such a heinous act, then the question becomes, we don't all go out and shoot people when we get divorced or we get demoted or we lose a job. So what is it? What is that factor that's different here and that puts a gun in the hand of a person, and that's the decision that they make? And because this happened in California, it was interesting to watch how the press handled it, because California does have stricter gun law. And what you were hearing is, well, look, that didn't work. But in fact, there's statistics to show that California has the least amount of gun violence, like they're in the top 7 states for having reduced gun violence. So what I hope this does, this mass shooting, doesn't wash away that actually legislation does work. And so when we're looking, you know, looking particularly at what motivated this particular case, again, we're talking about a mass shooting, but I do think we don't want to lose the fact that when we're dealing with 1 or 2 people that don't fall into that statistic, they have really made progress in that area.
Mary.
I want to follow on with Professor Johnson's response, and I want to say we all as humans are able to experience rage and depression and grief and have challenges with our mental health, all the feels. That is not, from my perspective, what's wrong with this situation. What is going wrong in this situation is that when we have all these feels, we have way too easy access to guns that have such an incredible lethality to them. So again, this common sense piece of, you know, that old tried thing, like guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, people have those feelings. I can completely agree with that. We all experiencing these ups and downs of life. However, when certain individuals have these feelings, they have way too easy access to guns, and guns are so lethal. So, okay, that was following on with Professor Johnson. I'm not sure this quote has much impact for me, right? And we've talked about how there isn't a lot of research. We've talked about how the research that is there isn't very compelling. I want to come back to something we've talked about a lot over our conversations, which is, where is there a place of agreement rather than where do we most vociferously disagree with each other? And I think this is nowhere more critical than in this conversation about guns. As I said before, I'm not clear about what should be done nor what can be done. However, giving into despair that leading to inaction is something that I am quite clear we all cannot do. So even with the uneven results and the data that's lacking, and I'm not a big person who's into data, the RAND gun policy in America did some studying and talking to folks, and they pulled together a group of individuals who were at opposite ends of this discussion. So people who were members of the NRA and people who were members of the Brady Group against handguns and folks, you know, really diametrically opposed. And they found four policy approaches that might both sides agree could be reasonable approaches, something to do. Those four things were state prosecution of people who are prohibited from seeking and owning firearms, expanded mental health prohibitions for people who can access firearms, the surrender of firearms by people who have been assessed to be prohibited to possess them, right? And prohibitions for firearms for individuals who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders. Those four policy actions don't seem, you know, it's not like someone's going to say, oh, these are the best things ever. However, they are a very rare place, according to this research, that says that people from both perspectives and in between might find some commonality towards. I think we should be pushing that for ourselves and for our strategies. RAND also goes on to say that even a 1% reduction in homicides from guns nationally would be approximately 2,500 fewer deaths over a 10-year period of time. I'm willing to take incrementalism in this moment and think that there would be 2,500 fewer deaths as a result of guns. The other thing I think about is when we look at this issue through an economic lens, I'm really interested and very ignorant about gun owner insurance. I think strategies that are targeted to looking at economic impact rather than moral impact or things that want to, you know, reify the family or children. I think looking at strategies that have an economic basis and an economic impact is a stronger potential pathway to pursue than trying to push some of the other ways that we've talked about this as prevention or preventative.
I appreciate that, Mary. What comes to mind for me off of this quote from the Washington Post is very much about our idea of solutions and to what extent do we empower people to find solutions and what does that really look like? And how do we frame it? And that is not to harp on, as many people do, well, they didn't teach you how to do your taxes in public high school, because they didn't and they probably should, but there's other reasons to go to school, right? But I think even in our popular culture, in the way that we raise children, the way that we are interpersonally, what is solutions? And here's the thing, out in the world, you can tell somebody who's been to therapy and somebody who hasn't, right? And there are certain aspects that are so fundamental about communication, about understanding someone other than oneself. And there are many, many ways that one is ill-equipped to deal with those things if you haven't had certain privileges of upbringing, certain types of people in your life, or the opportunity to be in some kind of behavioral health or mental health therapy. Many times, a solution is seen as dominance, is an entitlement to dominance. And I think that that underpins a lot of this, that especially talking about workplace related stuff, I think there are, at least as a woman, I have it in the back of my head, the people that I interact with in my personal life and, you know, wanting to have good relationships with them, but thinking that it could, that this kind of violence could come from your workplace is really scary, is really something that is difficult to deal with and difficult to wrap your head around, because we are so different when it comes to knowing how to resolve interpersonal conflict. And resolution is really recognition and acknowledgement of another person. That's what it comes down to. It doesn't come down to my point of view needs to be, or my personhood needs to be dominating over somebody else that I may be frustrated with, that I may be upset with. It is the acknowledgement and understanding between two people. And so I think that there's an aspect of that that could be expanded upon, but I also think that, like Mary was saying, any step in the direction of keeping vulnerable people, children especially, away from guns, making sure that they are locked in safes, that they're out of reach, that particular that people cannot access them nearly as easily as they do now. 2,500 more people being alive in the next 10 years sounds pretty good to me. And I think that because the conversation is so convoluted and at this point has turned into identity politics, that people become so ferociously like, I am a gun owner. If you say anything bad about guns, we're going to have an altercation about that because you're now threatening me and my person when we're talking about a thing that I own. I think that the real, I feel, excuse the phrasing, come to Jesus moment, maybe we're not ready for that yet, but moving in the direction of what can we do? One person being alive because of a law that was passed, I think that's a good thing. And we may, and the true impact of that, especially when we're talking about social science study, may not ever be able to be realized, but that is something that's important and something that we can strive for. And it feels like baby steps, but it's something that's important nonetheless.
You are listening to LTAR, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie.
The next thing I want to ask is adding in, obviously we mentioned racism and white supremacy culture as an aspect of this, but how do we address race and racial resentment in this gun violence epidemic? Does the analysis change when talking about gun violence from within racial groups? Mary, why don't you start?
Before I get to that, I just want to revisit some of what you were saying, Althea. You know, I think you were talking about empathy. Can we extend empathy outside of our own self into the other? And that skill to be able to do that is something that is very, very lacking in our country today. I also want to come back to this idea of ownership and entitlement, which takes me back to the original conversation that we were having about where does this come from? This is about ownership, ownership of the gun that translates into ownership of the person, that translates into the ownership of the land. This idea of ownership and entitlement is completely tied into the racial dynamics of this conversation and of this issue. If this, you know, some of the research that I have read says that it's estimated that almost 60% of us will experience some type of gun, like will touch some capacity gun violence in our lifetime. I bet I know what that 60% of us is comprised of. It's largely comprised of people of color. We are killed at the hands of state police force, and we adopt the oppressor's tools as a survival tactic. Again, I'm not going to, you know, there is a legacy, particularly within the African-American community, from the Panthers and others, to talk about armed resistance. And armed resistance as one of the last means available to a community that is being killed, daily in visibly violent and not so visibly violent ways. So I don't have a judgment about that. I have a judgment about when we have adopted this tool and we are using it against our own selves at the hands of the oppressors. I think, you know, folks are very happy to have drugs and violence and everything flood our communities in the 80s. And we're very happy for us to be shooting each other and to be perpetrating crime against each other, because it took our attention off of, you know, where the real oppression and where the real violence was coming from. So I think it's a complexity for us to understand us with us, what that looks like. When I had such ambivalent feelings when I heard that both of the killers in California at Monterey Park and at Half Moon Bay were Asian. On one hand, I felt incredible relief that we weren't having to deal with somewhat some white man killing us, as happened in Atlanta and in other places. And on the other hand, such rage that an Asian man would take this act, would take these acts against other Asian and other people of color because they were frustrated, or because they felt entitled, or because they, you know, were unhappy with a partner or socially or work, or some of the things that we've talked about here. And for me, it was the worst, worst example of assimilation and adoption and a completely wrong action in our community. And the Asian community and all of our communities of color, we got to deal with that. We got to own that. We got to understand it. And we got to start talking about it, because I don't think it's going to get any better.
Reverend Cecil?
There is too much violence in the Black communities, Black on Black violence. But there's also incredible ways in which we find ways in which, in spite of all these things, we find ways to celebrate and encourage. It also means systemic changes. Look at our education system. What is it about our education system which, by a time a Black child is in the second grade, they have already been labeled as someone who is a troublemaker, who is labeled to not go to college, but is labeled to go to the prison system. We have to find ways in which to affirm the beauty of our communities, and saying that person who you might have a beef with, you know, they're loved. They're loved by their grandmother. And we have to find ways in which to celebrate, to encourage, to hold deep. Part of the history of Black people in this nation in terms of finding ways to resist the violence, we need to recognize and honor those ways in which we continue to celebrate and find ways to acknowledge and affirm the beauty of our people and our communities.
Gun violence is a preventable public health tragedy affecting communities all over the United States. Every day, more than 100 Americans die by gun violence. Evidence shows that firearm ownership and access is associated with increased suicide, homicide, unintentional firearm deaths, and injuries. These injuries and deaths are preventable.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Listening to the news is experiencing one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we created a new segment to inspire. This segment is entitled, Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
Let's move on to our segment, Hope is a Thing with Feathers. Professor Johnson, would you like to start? What is your hope is a thing with feathers?
Sure, I will start. My hope with a thing with feathers is Cycle of Power program. And this is abandoned bicycles that are being repaired and shipped all across the United States and also in Africa as far as Madagascar for people to use. And they have over 1,000 volunteers, 11,000 bicycles a year that they are finding abandoned or otherwise in disrepair, that they're able to repair and send to people who can either use them for transportation to work or, to get around. And so I thought this was such an extraordinary effort at a grassroots level that had some pretty broad impact, so much so that now there has been some funding in the amount of like $3.2 million to look at ways to places where bicycles can be used effectively for transportation to work and figuring out how they can connect other programs around bicycles. So I thought that was a great story.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Mary, your hope is a thing with feathers.
My hope is to share the information that in the 100-year-old history of the Navajo Nation, despite being a matrilineal cultural nation, has never had a speaker of the nation who is a woman until now. And the first woman ever elected as speaker of the Navajo Nation, Krista Lynn Curley, is now going to serve her nation and her people in this role that many identify as, you know, more important to the nation and to the people than any of the other positions, and analogous to being the president of the United States or the vice president of the United States. So, you know, even 100 years later, justice can come, and representation still matters. And I am thrilled to welcome and acknowledge Speaker Curley and look forward to hearing her leadership and where she takes her people and tribes. Thanks.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race.
On this episode of Let's Talk About Race, the panel shares the history of voter suppression in the United States, which is as American as apple pie. With the 2022 midterms and all other elections, is the concept of one person, one vote, the cornerstone of democracy, still a thing? Let's talk about race. One person, no vote.
How does voter suppression operate? Where does it come from in American history, and where is it now?
Voter suppression has been a part of our democracy in this country from its inception.
Voter suppression has really been a part of American history from the very beginning.
Those who participated in this experiment in democracy were all property owners. They limited the access to power and to decision making from the very beginning of this democracy. There has been a move to increase voter participation and to increase the reality of citizens' participation in our society. So since that time of the founding of the Republic, we've witnessed the removal of the necessity to own property to vote, the granting of citizenship and the right to vote to formerly enslaved men came about with the 15th Amendment. In the 20th century, women gained the ability to vote. The 1965 Voting Rights Bill further expanded voting opportunity. And all these things created a situation where more and more people were able to participate in this experiment called democracy. Many citizens in all over the United States are battling efforts to restrict voting access and the ability for people to participate in the decision-making process in this nation.
I think we see it in both individual and systemic manifestations. It's a long continuum. So you have individual intimidation, you have ways in which people are challenged, and then you see the systems that are in place that include gerrymandering and some of the intimidation, the time and place restrictions that people are putting on voting boxes and when people can vote and how votes get collected and by whom. And you have in some places these vigilante police being funded and basically sent out to do whatever they want related to their opinion of whether voting is happening correctly or not happening correctly. I think we have to understand that our ancestors died for the right to vote. And that struggle has never gone away.
They left the actual management of the vote to the states. And that's where the problem comes in, because not all states treated voting in the same manner. And this is a problem that we're struggling with now. So you asked about voter suppression and how it operates. I think it's changed over time. The intent has been to disenfranchise certain parts of the population. And they've done that in different ways. For example, in Mississippi in 1892, everyone could vote. They wound up with two black senators and then decided that wasn't going to work out for them and instituted a grandfather clause, which said that the people that were permitted to vote was anyone whose grandfather was qualified to vote. So that clearly left out 90% of the black population. That's an example of targeting and excluding certain groups of people to manipulate the outcome. It wasn't until 1964, which has really been 60 years, basically, since outlawed poll taxes. And that's something to think about, just 60 years, even though we supposedly had the right to vote, you know, since 1776. There have been efforts to broaden and include more diverse population, but you always have this sort of reeling back trying to exclude certain groups. What we see now is, again, another effort to manipulate the outcome of elections. And it's almost been reduced to basically, if I didn't win, then the election was a fraud.
It may be facially neutral. The types of laws about voting that are attempted to be passed across this country, but they are targeted at specific people. Voter ID laws, for example, can make it extremely hard to vote if you're trans or non-binary. In Georgia, they were passing laws about not allowing folks to bring food or water to those waiting in line to vote, or eliminating Sunday voting. In other parts of the country, they've made their residency requirements or having a physical address much more strict, and that in its own way targets Native populations who often don't have the same address set up on reservations. All of these things taken in a vacuum with no context, with no historical knowledge, maybe that's fine. But understanding the history, understanding what it is that is the goal here, which is controlling electoral outcomes, mind you, not by coming up with policies that are preferred by the majority of voters, which is hypothetically one way you could try to win, but instead manipulating the true will of the people.
Some people, quite honestly, do not believe in democracy, and they are feel emboldened to say that out loud.
This idea of we need fewer voters, but we need better voters. I think we understand what the code language is for who is a better voter and who is not. This dynamic rests in a couple of things. It rests in the great replacement theory, which is such an underlying base belief for the radical right. And that's buttressed by white supremacy culture, which says the better voters are the white voters. You see this through the disenfranchisement of people with felony convictions. And we know that the criminal justice system is not fair. It is discriminatory to people of color. All of these are not coincidences. That's not by accident. And it certainly flies in the face of one person, one vote, our democracy, our popular practices are the will of the people. That is not democracy. We have a very cynical view, and I would say, particularly for the radical right, a lack of really belief in democracy. Although I don't think people used to say this, more and more people are saying, I don't believe in democracy because I don't believe that those people are good enough, smart enough, righteous enough, whatever the enough is, to be able to have the privilege of voting, and that should be reserved for people like me and the people who believe the way I believe. And you said something, Althea, which I thought was very, you know, they can't trust that their agenda is compelling enough or important enough or persuasive enough that it could win on its own. They have to take these steps and these measures in order to ensure that their perspective and their agenda will be the one that prevails.
It is amazing that countries throughout the world over the past 100, 150 years have often looked to the United States, not because the United States was perfect, but because it created a document, the U.S. Constitution, based on a vision of how people could live that allow people to dream and to say we can create something similar in our society. And that was a dream. But what happens, as Langston Hughes says, when a dream is deferred? What happens when we abandon the dream? That is what we are experiencing in recent decades.
We have moved away from what is the common good, the concept of what is good for the majority of people, and the individual agendas have taken over. Part of the reason I think we've lost the common good, we are now looking at a voting population that really has never been called upon to embrace that concept. And part of that, I think, is education. Part of that is our political maneuvering that's gone on. Part of that is white supremacy that has taken over in our institutions. There's a lot to unpack for why this has happened. If we don't figure out a way to align people around the common good, then the inevitable will happen and democracy will fail.
Democracy is envisioned as the antidote to the tyranny of the few. Democracy isn't going well if there is significant concentration of political power in the hands of the few. In terms of who should vote, who shouldn't vote, if you believe in democracy, people should be able to vote. We should not have political power concentrated in the hands of the few. We should not have decision-making authority. No taxation without representation, right? Like, that's the first thing you learn. They tell you that one in second grade. The consent of the governed is an important concept, theoretically. If you want to make some change in your community, you should have community consensus to make that happen. And democracy is how we've envisioned that.
I think the first thing that we can do to start to arrest this kind of decline is, first of all, admit to it. Be concrete. Say, yeah, we did it. It was wrong and we shouldn't do it again. The second thing would be to make the commitment that even if we saw the advantage for quote unquote our side, we won't take it. We would measure ourselves by the common good. We would measure ourselves by the greater benefit to the most. And I think the third thing that we have to do is we have to vote.
Those were excerpts from our show, Let's Talk About Race.
One person, no vote.
Thanks for taking a look back with us. All of our previous episodes can be found online by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR, and listen to us regularly on your local community radio station.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroot News Northwest.
Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kbu.fm/earthday.
Yeah. A little bit after the 8 o'clock hour, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Time to stick around for a different nature.